Our man slid down the banister with perfect balance and landed in front of us.
Isis and Horus, he said, I see you found new bodies.
His eyes were a dozen colours, shifting like a kaleidoscope with hypnotic effect. I managed to stutter, we're not...
Oh, I see, he said. Trying to share the body, eh? Don't think I'm fooled for a minute, Isis. I know you're in charge.
But she's not, I protested. My name is Sadie Kane. I assume you're Toth? He raised an eyebrow.
You claim not to know me? Of course I'm Toth. Also called Jehuti. Also called...
I stifled a laugh. Jehuti? Toth looked offended.
In ancient Egyptian, it's a perfectly fine name. The Greeks called me Toth. Then later they confused me with their god Hermes. Even had the nerve to rename my sacred city Hermopolis, though we're nothing alike. Believe me, if you've ever met Hermes...
Ugh! Hufu yelled through a mouthful of Cheerios.
You're right, Toth agreed. I'm getting off track. So, you claim to be Sadie Kane, and...
He swung a finger toward Carter, who was watching the Ibises type on their laptops.
I suppose you're not Horus?
Carter Kane, said Carter, still distracted by the Ibises' screens. What is that? Toth brightened.
Yes, they're called computers. Marvelous, aren't they? Apparently...
No, I mean, what are the birds typing? Carter squinted and read from the screen. A short treatise on the evolution of yaks?
My scholarly essays, Toth explained. I try to keep several projects going at once. For instance, did you know this university does not offer majors in astrology or leechcraft? Shocking. I intend to change that. I'm renovating new headquarters right now down by the river. Soon, Memphis will be a true center of learning.
That's brilliant, I said half-heartedly. We need help defeating Set. The Ibises stopped typing and stared at me. Toth wiped the barbecue sauce off his mouth.
You have the nerve to ask this after last time?
Last time? I repeated.
I have the account here somewhere.
Toth patted the pockets of his lab coat. He pulled out a rumpled piece of paper and read it.
No, grocery list.
He tossed it over his shoulder. As soon as the paper hit the floor, it became a loaf of wheat bread, a jug of milk, and a six-pack of Mountain Dew. Toth checked his sleeves. I realized the stains on his coat were smeared words, printed in every language. The stains moved and changed, forming hieroglyphs, English letters, demotic symbols. He brushed a stain off his lapel, and seven letters fluttered to the floor, forming a word, Crawdad. The word morphed into a slimy crustacean like a shrimp, which wiggled its legs for only a moment before an ibis snapped it up.
Oh, never mind, Toth said at last. I'll just tell you the short version. To avenge his father, Osiris, Horus challenged Set to a duel. The winner would become king of the gods.
Horus won, Carter said.
You do remember?
No, I read about it.
And do you remember that without my help, Isis and you both would have died? Oh, I tried to mediate a solution to prevent the battle. That is one of my jobs, you know, to keep balance between order and chaos. But no, Isis convinced me to help your side because Set was getting too powerful. And the battle almost destroyed the world.
He complains too much, Isis said inside my head. It wasn't so bad.
No,
Toth demanded, and I got the feeling he could hear her voice as well as I could.
Set stabbed out Horus's eye.
Ouch, Carter blinked.
Yes, and I replaced it with a new eye made of moonlight. The Eye of Horus, your famous symbol. That was me, thank you very much. And when you cut off Isis's head...
Hold up, Carter glanced at me. I cut off her head?
I got better, Isis assured me.
Only because I healed you, Isis, Toth said. And yes, Carter, Horus, whatever you call yourself, you were so mad you cut off her head. You were reckless, you see, about to charge Set while you were still weak, and Isis tried to stop you. That made you so angry you took your sword. Well, the point is, you almost destroyed each other before you could defeat Set. If you start another fight with the Red Lord, beware. He will use chaos to turn you against each other.
We'll defeat him again, Isis promised. Toph is just jealous.
Shut up, Toph and I said at the same time.
He looked at me with surprise.
So, Sadie, you are trying to stay in control. It won't last. You may be blood of the pharaohs, but Isis is a deceptive, power-hungry...
I can contain her, I said, and I had to use all my will to keep Isis from blurting out a string of insults. Toth fingered the frets of his guitar.
Don't be so sure. Isis probably told you she helped defeat Set. Did she also tell you she was the reason Set got out of control in the first place? She exiled our first king.
You mean Ra? Carter said. Didn't he get old and decide to leave the Earth?
Toth snorted. He was old, yes, but he was forced to leave. Isis got tired of waiting for him to retire. She wanted her husband, Osiris, to become king. She also wanted more power. So one day, while Ra was napping, Isis secretly collected a bit of the sun god's drool.
Ew, I said. Since when does drool make you powerful? Toth scowled at me accusingly.
You mixed the spit with clay to create a poisonous snake. That night, the serpent slipped into Ra's bedroom and bit him on the ankle. No amount of magic, even mine, could heal him. He would have died.
Gods can die? Carter asked.
Oh, yes, Toth said. Of course, most of the time, we rise again from the Duat, eventually. But this poison ate away at Ra's very being. Isis, of course, acted innocent. She cried to see Ra in pain. She tried to help with her magic. Finally, she told Ra there was only one way to save him. Ra must tell her his secret name.
Secret name? I asked. Like Bruce Wayne?
Everything in creation has a secret name, Toth said. Even gods. To know a being's secret name is to have power over that creature. Isis promised that with Ra's secret name, she could heal him. Ra was in so much pain, he agreed. And Isis healed him.
But it gave her power over him, Carter guessed.
Extreme power, Toth agreed. She forced Ra to retreat into the heavens, opening the way for her beloved Osiris to become the new king of the gods. Set had been an important lieutenant to Ra, but he could not bear to see his brother Osiris become king. This made Set and Osiris enemies, and here we are. 5 millennia later, still fighting that war, all because of Isis.
But that's not my fault, I said. I would never do something like that.
Wouldn't you? Toth asked. Wouldn't you do anything to save your family, even if it upset the balance of the cosmos?
His kaleidoscope eyes locked on mine, and I felt a surge of defiance. Well, why shouldn't I help my family? Who was this nutter in a lab coat telling me what I could and couldn't do? Then I realized I didn't know who was thinking that, Isis or me. Panic started building in my chest. If I couldn't tell my own thoughts from those of Isis, how long before I went completely mad? No, Toth, I croaked. You have to believe me. I'm in control, me, Sadie, and I need your help. Set has our father. I let it spill out then. Everything from the British Museum to Carter's vision of the Red Pyramid. Toth listened without comment, but I could swear new stains developed on his lab coat as I talked, as if some of my words were being added to the mix. "Just look at something for us," I finished. "Carter, hand him the book." Carter rummaged through his bag and brought out the book we'd stolen from Paris.
"You wrote this, right?" he said.
"It tells how to defeat Set."
Toth unfolded the papyrus pages.
dear. I hate reading my old work. Look at this sentence. I'd never write it that way now.
He patted his lab coat pockets.
Red pen. Does anyone have one?
Isis chafed against my willpower, insisting that we blast some sense into Toth.
One fireball, she pleaded. Just one enormous magical fireball, please.
I can't say I wasn't tempted, but I kept her under control.
Look, Toth, I said, Jehuti, whatever, Set is about to destroy North America at the very least, possibly the world. Millions of people will die. You said you care about balance. Will you help us or not?
For a moment, the only sounds were Ibis beaks tapping on keyboards.
You are in trouble,
Toth agreed.
So let me ask, why do you think your father put you in this position? Why did he release the gods?
I almost said to bring back Mum, but I didn't believe that anymore.
My mum saw the future, I guessed. Something bad was coming. I think she and Dad were trying to stop it. They thought the only way was to release the gods.
Even though using the power of the gods is incredibly dangerous for mortals,
Toth pressed,
and against the law of the House of Life? A law that I convinced Iskander to make, by the way.
I remembered something the old Chief Lector had told me in the Hall of Ages. Gods have great power, but only humans have creativity. I think my mum convinced Iskander that the rule was wrong. Maybe he couldn't admit it publicly, but she made him change his mind. Whatever is coming, it's so bad, gods and mortals are going to need each other.
And what is coming? Toth asked. The rise of Set?
His tone was coy, like a teacher trying a trick question.
Maybe, I said carefully, but I don't know.
Up on the bookshelf, Hufu belched. He bared his fangs in a messy grin.
You have a point, Hufu, Toth mused. She does not sound like Isis. Isis would never admit she doesn't know something.
I had to clamp a mental hand over Isis's mouth. Toth tossed the book back to Carter.
Let's see if you act as well as you talk. I will explain the spell book, provided you prove to me that you truly have control of your gods, that you're not simply repeating the same old patterns.
A test? Carter said. We accept.
Now, hang on, I protested. Maybe being homeschooled, Carter didn't realize that test is normally a bad thing.
Wonderful, Toth said. There is an item of power I require from a magician's tomb. Bring it to me.
Which magician's tomb? I asked, but Toth took a piece of chalk from his lab coat and scribbled something in the air. A doorway opened in front of him.
How did you do that?
I asked. Bast said we can't summon portals during the demon days.
Mortals can't, Toth agreed, but a god of magic can. If you succeed, we'll have barbecue.
The doorway pulled us into a black void, and Toth's office disappeared. 24. I blow up some blue suede shoes.
Where are we?
I asked. We stood on a deserted avenue outside the gates of a large estate. We still seemed to be in Memphis, at least the trees, the weather, the afternoon light were all the same. The estate must have been several acres, at least. The white metal gates were done in fancy designs of silhouetted guitar players and musical notes. Beyond them, the driveway curved through the trees up to a two-story house with a white-columned portico.
Oh, no. Carter said, I recognize those gates.
What? Why?
Dad brought me here once. A great magician's tomb. Toth has got to be kidding.
Carter, what are you talking about? Is someone buried here? He nodded.
This is Graceland, home to the most famous musician in the world.
Michael Jackson lived here?
No, dummy, Carter said. Elvis Presley.
I wasn't sure whether to laugh or curse.
Elvis Presley.
You mean white suits with rhinestones, big slick hair, Grand's record collection, that Elvis? Carter looked around nervously. He drew his sword, even though we seemed to be totally alone. This is where he lived and died. He's buried in back of the mansion. I stared up at the house. You're telling me Elvis was a magician? Don't know. Carter gripped his sword. Toth did say something about music being a kind of magic, but something's not right. Why are we the only ones here? There's usually a mob of tourists. Christmas holidays? But no security? I shrugged. Maybe it's like what Zia did at Luxor. Maybe Toth cleared everyone out. Maybe. But I could tell Carter was still uneasy. He pushed the gates, and they opened easily. Not right, he muttered. No, I agreed. But let's go pay our respects. As we walked up the drive, I couldn't help thinking that the home of the king wasn't very impressive. Compared to some of the rich and famous homes I'd seen on TV, Elvis's place looked awfully small. It was just two stories high, with that white-columned portico and brick walls. Ridiculous plaster lions flanked the steps. Perhaps things were simpler back in Elvis's day, or maybe he spent all his money on rhinestone suits. We stopped at the foot of the steps. "So, Dad brought you here?" I asked. "Yeah." Carter eyed the lions as if expecting them to attack. "Dad loves blues and jazz, mostly, but he said Elvis was important because he took African-American music and made it popular for white people. He helped invent rock and roll. Anyway, Dad and I were in town for a symposium or something. I don't remember. Dad insisted I come here." "Lucky you." And yes, perhaps I was beginning to understand that Carter's life with Dad hadn't been all glamour and holiday, but still I couldn't help being a bit jealous. Not that I'd ever wanted to see Graceland, of course, but Dad had never insisted on taking me anywhere, at least until the British Museum trip when he disappeared. I hadn't even known Dad was an Elvis fan, which was rather horrifying. We walked up the steps. The front door swung open all by itself. "I don't like that," Carter said. I turned to look behind us, and my blood went ice cold. I grabbed my brother's arm. "Carter? Speaking of things we don't like..." Coming up the driveway were two magicians brandishing staffs and wands. "Inside," Carter said. "Quick!" I didn't have much time to admire the house. There was a dining room to our left, and a living room music room to our right, with a piano and a stained glass archway decorated with peacocks. All the furniture was roped off. The house smelled like old people. "Item of power," I said. "Where?" "I don't know," Carter snapped. "They didn't have items of power listed on the tour." I glanced out the window. Our enemies were getting close. The bloke in front wore jeans, a black sleeveless shirt, boots, and a battered cowboy hat. He looked more like an outlaw than a magician. His friend was similarly dressed, but much heftier, with tattooed arms, a bald head, and a scraggly beard. When they were 10 meters away, the man with the cowboy hat lowered his staff, which morphed into a shotgun. "Oh, please," I yelled, and pushed Carter into the living room. The blast shattered Elvis's front door and set my ears ringing. We scrambled to our feet and ran deeper into the house. We passed through an old-fashioned kitchen, then into the strangest den I'd ever seen. The back wall was made of vine-covered bricks with a waterfall trickling down the side. The carpet was green shag, floor and ceiling, mind you, and the furniture was carved with creepy animal shapes, just in case all that wasn't dreadful enough. Plaster monkeys and stuffed lions had been strategically placed around the room. Despite the danger we were in, the place was so horrid I just had to stop and marvel. "God," I said, "did Elvis have no taste?" "The jungle room," Carter said. "He decorated it like this to annoy his dad." "I can respect that." Another shotgun blast roared through the house. "Split up," Carter said. "Bad idea." I could hear the magicians tromping through the rooms, smashing things as they came closer. "I'll distract them," Carter said. "You search. The trophy room is through there." "Carter!" But the fool ran off to protect me. I hate it when he does that. I should have followed him or run the other way, but I stood frozen in shock as he turned the corner with his sword raised, his body beginning to glow with a golden light, and everything went wrong. Blam! An emerald flash brought Carter to his knees. For a heartbeat, I thought he'd been hit with the shotgun, and I had to stifle a scream. But immediately, Carter collapsed and began to shrink, clothes, sword and all, melting into a tiny sliver of green. The lizard that used to be my brother raced toward me, climbed up my leg and into my palm, where it looked at me desperately. From around the corner, a gruff voice said,
"Split up and find the sister. She'll be somewhere close."
"Oh, Carter," I whispered fondly to the lizard. "I will so kill you for this." I stuffed him in my pocket and ran. The two magicians continued to smash and crash their way through Graceland, knocking over furniture and blasting things to bits. Apparently they were not Elvis fans. I ducked under some ropes, crept through a hallway, and found the trophy room. Amazingly, it was full of trophies. Gold records crowded the walls. Rhinestone Elvis jumpsuits glittered in four glass cases. The room was dimly lit, probably to keep the jumpsuits from blinding visitors, and music played softly from overhead speakers. Elvis warning everyone not to step on his blue suede shoes. I scanned the room, but found nothing that looked magical. The suits? I hoped Toth did not expect me to wear one. The gold records? Lovely frisbees, but no.
"Jared!"
a voice called to my right. A magician was coming down the hallway. I darted toward the other exit, but a voice just outside it called back,
"Yeah, I'm over here."
I was surrounded.
"Carter," I whispered, "curse your lizard brain."
He fluttered nervously in my pocket, but was no help. I fumbled through my magician's bag and grasped my wand. Should I try drawing a magic circle? No time, and I didn't want to duel toe-to-toe with two older magicians. I had to stay mobile. I took out my rod and willed it into a full-length staff. I could set it on fire or turn it into a lion, but what good would that do? My hands started to tremble. I wanted to crawl into a ball and hide beneath Elvis's gold record collection.
"Let me take over," Isis said. "I can turn our enemies to dust."
"No," I told her.
"You will get us both killed."
I could feel her pressing against my will, trying to bust out. I could taste her anger with these magicians. How dare they challenge us? With a word, we could destroy them.
"No," I thought again. Then I remembered something Zia had said. "Use whatever you have available."
The room was dimly lit. Perhaps if I could make it darker.
"Darkness," I whispered.
I felt a tugging sensation in my stomach, and the lights flickered off. The music stopped. The light continued to dim. Even the sunlight faded from the windows until the entire room went black. Somewhere to my left, the first magician sighed in exasperation.
"Jared!"
"Wasn't me, Wayne,"
Jared insisted.
"You always blame me."
Wayne muttered something in Egyptian, still moving towards me. I needed a distraction. I closed my eyes and imagined my surroundings. Although it was pitch black, I could still sense Jared in the hallway to my left, stumbling through the darkness. I sensed Wayne on the other side of the wall to the right, only a few steps from the doorway. And I could visualize the four glass display cases with Elvis's suits.
"They're tossing your house," I thought. "Defend it!"
A stronger pull in my gut, as if I were lifting a heavy weight. Then the display cases blew open. I heard the shuffling of stiff cloth like sails in the wind and was dimly aware of four pale white shapes in motion, two heading to either door. Wayne yelled first as the empty Elvis suits tackled him. His shotgun lit up the dark. Then to my left, Jared shouted in surprise. A heavy clump told me he'd been knocked over. I decided to go in Jared's direction. Better an off-balance bloke than one with a shotgun. I slipped through the doorway and down a hall, leaving Jared scuffling behind me and yelling,
"Get off! Get off!"
"Take him while he's down," Isis urged. "Burn him to ashes."
Part of me knew she had a point. If I left Jared in one piece, he would be up in no time and after me again. But it didn't seem right to hurt him, especially while he was being tackled by Elvis suits. I found a door and burst outside into the afternoon sunlight. I was in the backyard of Graceland. A large fountain gurgled nearby, ringed by grave markers. One had a glass-encased flame at the top and was heaped with flowers. I took a wild guess. It must be Elvis's. A magician's tomb. Of course. We'd been searching the house, but the item of power would be at his gravesite. But what exactly was the item? Before I could approach the grave, the door burst open. The big, bald man with the straggly beard stumbled out. A tattered Elvis suit had its sleeves wrapped around his neck like it was getting a piggyback ride.
"Well, well,"
the magician threw off the jumpsuit. His voice confirmed for me that he was the one called Jared.
"You're just a little girl. You've caused us a lot of trouble, missy."
He lowered his staff and fired a shot of green light. I raised my wand and deflected the bolt of energy straight up. I heard a surprised coo, the cry of a pigeon, and a newly made lizard fell out of the sky at my feet. "Sorry," I told it. Jared snarled and threw down his staff. Apparently he specialized in lizards, because the staff morphed into a Komodo dragon the size of a London taxicab. The monster charged me with unnatural speed. It opened its jaws and would have bitten me in half, but I just had time to wedge my staff in its mouth. Jared laughed.
"Nice try, girl."
I felt the dragon's jaws pressing on the staff. It was only a matter of seconds before the wood snapped, and then I'd be a Komodo dragon's snack. "A little help," I told Isis. Carefully, very carefully, I tapped into her strength. Doing so without letting her take over was like riding a surfboard over a tidal wave, trying desperately to stay on my feet. I felt 5,000 years of experience, knowledge, and power course through me. She offered me options, and I selected the simplest. I channeled power through my staff and felt it grow hot in my hands, glowing white. The dragon hissed and gurgled as my staff elongated, forcing the creature's jaws open wider, wider, and then... boom! The dragon shattered into kindling and sent the splintered remains of Jared's staff raining down around me. Jared had only a moment to look stunned before I threw my wand and whapped him solidly on the forehead. His eyes crossed, and he collapsed on the pavement. My wand returned to my hand. That would have been a lovely, happy ending. Except I'd forgotten about Wayne. The cowboy-hatted magician stumbled out the door, almost tripping over his friend, but he recovered with lightning speed. He shouted, "Wind!" and my staff flew out of my hands and into his. He smiled cruelly.
"Well fought, darling, but elemental magic is always quickest."
He stuck the ends of both staffs, his and mine, against the pavement. A wave rippled over the dirt and pavement as if the ground had become liquid, knocking me off my feet and sending my wand flying. I scrambled backwards on hands and knees, but I could hear Wayne chanting, summoning fire from the staffs. "Rope," Isis said. "Every magician carries rope." Panic had made my mind go blank, but my hand instinctively went for my magic bag. I pulled out a small bit of twine, hardly a rope, but it triggered a memory, something Zia had done in the New York Museum. I threw the twine at Wayne and yelled a word Isis suggested. "Tass!" A golden hieroglyph burned in the air over Wayne's head. The twine whipped toward him like an angry snake, growing longer and thicker as it flew. Wayne's eyes widened. He stumbled back and sent jets of flame shooting from both staffs, but the rope was too quick. It lashed round his ankles and toppled him sideways, wrapping round his whole body until he was encased in a twine cocoon from chin to toes. He struggled and screamed and called me quite a few unflattering names. I got up unsteadily. Jared was still out cold. I retrieved my staff, which had fallen next to Wayne. He continued straining against the twine and cursing in Egyptian, which sounded strange with an American southern accent. "Finish him," Isis warned. "He can still speak. He will not rest until he destroys you."
"Fire!" Wayne screamed. "Water!" Cheese!
Even the cheese command did not work. I reckoned his rage was throwing his magic off balance, making it impossible to focus, but I knew he would recover soon. Silence, I said. Wayne's voice abruptly stopped working. He kept screaming, but no sound came out. I'm not your enemy, I told him, but I can't have you killing me either. Something wriggled in my pocket, and I remembered Carter. I took him out. He looked okay, except, of course, for the fact he was still a lizard. I'll try to change you back, I told him. Hopefully I don't make things worse. He made a little croak that didn't convey much confidence. I closed my eyes and imagined Carter as he should be, a tall boy of 14, badly dressed, very human, very annoying. Carter began to feel heavy in my hands. I put him down and watched as the lizard grew into a vaguely human blob. By the count of three, my brother was lying on his stomach, his sword and pack next to him on the lawn. He spit grass out of his mouth. "How'd you do that?" "I don't know," I admitted. "You just seemed wrong." "Thanks a lot." He got up and checked to make sure he had all his fingers. Then he saw the two magicians and his mouth fell open. "What did you do to them?" "Just tied one up, knocked one out. Magic." "No, I mean," he faltered, searching for words, then gave up and pointed. I looked at the magicians and yelped. Wayne wasn't moving. His eyes and mouth were open, but he wasn't blinking or breathing. Next to him, Jared looked just as frozen. As we watched, their mouths began to glow as if they'd swallowed matches. Two tiny yellow orbs of fire popped out from between their lips and shot into the air, disappearing in the sunlight. "What? What was that?" I asked. "Are they dead?" Carter approached them cautiously and put his hand on Wayne's neck. "It doesn't even feel like skin. More like rock." "No, they were human. I didn't turn them to rock." Carter felt Jared's forehead where I'd whacked him with my wand. "It's cracked." "What?" Carter picked up his sword. Before I could even scream, he brought the hilt down on Jared's face and the magician's head cracked into shards like a flower pot. "They're made of clay," Carter said. "They're both Shapti." He kicked Wayne's arm and I heard it crunch under the twine. "But they were casting spells," I said, "and talking. They were real." As we watched, the Shapti crumbled to dust, leaving nothing behind but my bit of twine, two staffs, and some grungy clothes. "Toth was testing us," Carter guessed. "Those balls of fire, though." He frowned as if trying to recall something important. "Probably the magic that animated them," I guessed, "flying back to their master, like a recording of what they did." It sounded like a solid theory to me, but Carter seemed awfully troubled. He pointed to the blasted back door of Graceland. "Is the whole house like that?" "Worse." I looked at the ruined Elvis jumpsuit under Jared's clothes and scattered rhinestones. Maybe Elvis had no taste, but I still felt bad about trashing the king's palace. If the place had been important to Dad... Suddenly, an idea perked me up. "What was it Amos said when he repaired that saucer?" Carter frowned. "This is a whole house, Sadie, not a saucer." "Got it," I said. "Hi, Neem!" A gold hieroglyphic symbol, including an urn and an owl, flickered to life in my palm. I held it up and blew it towards the house. The entire outline of Graceland began to glow. The pieces of the door flew back into place and mended themselves. The tattered bits of Elvis clothing disappeared. "Wow," Carter said. "Do you think the inside is fixed too?" My vision blurred and my knees buckled. I would have knocked my head on the pavement if Carter hadn't caught me. "It's okay," he said. "You did a lot of magic, Sadie. That was amazing. But we haven't even found the item Toth sent us for." "Yeah," Carter said. "Maybe we have." He pointed to Elvis's grave, and I saw it clearly. A memento left behind by some adoring fan. A necklace with a silver loop-topped cross, just like the one on Mum's T-shirt in my old photograph. "An Ankh," I said. the Egyptian symbol for eternal life. Carter picked it up. There was a small papyrus scroll attached to the chain. "What's this?" he murmured, and unrolled the sheet. He stared at it so hard I thought he'd burn a hole in it. "What?" I looked over his shoulder. The painting looked quite ancient. It showed a golden spotted cat holding a knife in one paw and chopping the head off a snake. Beneath it, in black marker, someone had written, "Keep up the fight." "That's vandalism, isn't it?" I asked, marking up an ancient drawing like that. Rather an odd thing to leave for Elvis. Carter didn't seem to hear. "I've seen this picture before. It's in a lot of tombs. Don't know why it never occurred to me." I studied the picture more closely. Something about it did seem rather familiar. "You know what it means?" I asked. "It's the Cat of Ra, fighting the sun god's main enemy, Apophis." "The snake," I said. "Yeah, Apophis was the embodiment of chaos," I said, remembering what Nut had said. Carter looked impressed, as well he should have. "Exactly. Apophis was even worse than Set. The Egyptians thought doomsday would come when Apophis ate the sun and destroyed all of creation." "But the cat killed it," I said hopefully. "The cat had to kill it over and over again," Carter said. "Like what Toth said about repeating patterns. The thing is, I asked Dad one time if the cat had a name, and he said nobody knows for sure, but most people assume it's Sekhmet, this fierce lion goddess. She was called the Eye of Ra because she did his dirty work. He saw an enemy, she killed it." "Fine. So?" "So the cat doesn't look like Sekhmet. It just occurred to me. I finally saw it, and a shiver went down my back. The Cat of Ra looks exactly like Muffin. It's Bast." Just then the ground rumbled. The memorial fountain began to glow, and a dark doorway opened. "Come on," I said. "I've got some questions for Toth. And then I'm going to punch him in the beak."
25. We win an all-expenses-paid trip to death. Being turned into a lizard can really mess up your day. As we stepped through the doorway, I tried to hide it, but I was feeling pretty bad. You're probably thinking, hey, you already turned into a falcon, what's the big deal? But someone else forcing you into another form, that's totally different. Imagine yourself in a trash compactor, your entire body smashed into a shape smaller than your hand. It's painful, and it's humiliating. Your enemy pictures you as a stupid, harmless lizard, then imposes their will on you, overpowering your thoughts until you have to be what they want you to be. I guess it could have been worse. He could have pictured me as a fruit bat. But still. Of course, I felt grateful to Sadie for saving me, but I also felt like a complete loser. It was bad enough that I'd embarrassed myself on the basketball court with a troop of baboons, but I'd also totally failed in battle. Maybe I'd done okay with Leroy, the airport monster, but faced with a couple of magicians, even clay ones, I got turned into a reptile in the first 2 seconds. How would I stand a chance against Set? I was shaken out of those thoughts when we emerged from the portal, because we were definitely not in Toth's office. In front of us loomed a life-size glass and metal pyramid, almost as big as the ones at Giza. The skyline of downtown Memphis rose up in the distance. At our backs were the banks of the Mississippi River. The sun was setting, turning the river and the pyramid to gold. On the pyramid's front steps, next to a 20-foot-tall pharaoh statue labeled Ramses the Great, Toth had set out a picnic with barbecued ribs and brisket, bread and pickles, the works. He was playing his guitar with a portable amp. Hufu stood nearby, covering his ears.
"Oh, good."
Toth strummed a chord that sounded like the death cry of a sick donkey.
"You lived."
I stared up at the pyramid in amazement. Where did this come from? You didn't just build it, did you? I remembered my Ba trip to Set's Red Pyramid and suddenly pictured gods building monuments all over the U.S. Toth chuckled.
I didn't have to build it. The people of Memphis did that. Humans never really forget Egypt, you know. Every time they build a city on the banks of a river, they remember their heritage, buried deep in their subconscious. This is the Pyramid Arena, sixth largest pyramid in the world. It used to be a sports arena for... What is that game you like, Hufu?
Oh!
Hufu said indignantly, and I swear he gave me a dirty look.
Yes, basketball,
Toth said.
But the arena fell on hard times. It's been abandoned for years. Well, no longer. I'm moving in. You do have the Ankh.
For a moment, I wondered if it had been such a good idea helping Toth. But we needed him. I tossed him the necklace.
Excellent, he said. An Ankh from the tomb of Elvis. Powerful magic.
Sadie clenched her fists.
We almost died getting that. You tricked us.
Not a trick, he insisted. A test.
Those things, Sadie said. The Shabti.
Yes, my best work in centuries. A shame to break them, but I couldn't have you beaten up on real magicians, could I? Shabti make excellent stunt doubles.
So you saw the whole thing, I muttered.
Oh, yes.
Toth held out his hand. Two little fires danced across his palm, the magic essences we'd seen escape from the Shabti's mouths.
These are recording devices, I suppose you'd say. I got a full report. You defeated the Shabti without killing. I must admit, I'm impressed, Sadie. You controlled your magic and controlled Isis. And you, Carter, did well turning into a lizard.
I thought he was teasing me. Then I realized there was genuine sympathy in his eyes, as if my failure had also been some kind of test.
You will find worse enemies ahead, Carter, he warned. Even now, the House of Life sends its best against you. But you will also find friends where you least expect them.
I didn't know why, but I got the feeling he was talking about Zia. Or maybe that was just wishful thinking. Toth stood and handed Hufu his guitar. He tossed the Ankh at the statue of Ramses, and the necklace fastened itself around the pharaoh's neck.
There you are, Ramses, Toth said to the statue. Here's to our new life.
The statue glowed faintly, as if the sunset had just gotten 10 times brighter. Then the glow spread to the entire pyramid before slowly fading.
Oh, yes, Toth mused. I think I'll be happy here. Next time you children visit me, I'll have a much bigger laboratory.
Scary thought, but I tried to stay focused. That's not all we found, I said. You need to explain this. I held out the painting of the cat and the snake.
It's a cat and a snake, Toth said.
Thank you, God of Wisdom. You placed it for us to find, didn't you? You're trying to give us some kind of clue.
Who, me?
Just kill him, Horus said.
Shut up, I said.
At least kill the guitar.
The cat is bossed, I said, trying to ignore my inner psycho falcon. Does this have something to do with why our parents released the gods? Toth gestured toward the picnic plates.
Did I mention we have barbecue?
Sadie stomped her foot.
We had a deal, Jahuti.
You know, I like that name, Toth mused, but not so much when you say it. I believe our deal was that I would explain how to use the spell book. May I?
He held out his hand. Reluctantly, I dug the magic book out of my bag and handed it over. Toth unfolded the pages.
Ah, this takes me back. So many formulae. In the old days, we believed in ritual. A good spell might take weeks to prepare, with exotic ingredients from all over the world.
We don't have weeks, I said.
Rush, rush, rush,
Toth sighed.
Ugh,
Hufu agreed, sniffing the guitar. Toth closed the book and handed it back to me.
Well, it's an incantation for destroying Set.
We know that, Sadie said. Will it destroy him forever?
No, no. But it will destroy his form in this world, banishing him deep into the Duat and reducing his power so he will not be able to appear again for a long, long time. Centuries, most likely.
Sounds good, I said. How do we read it?
Toth stared at me like the answer should be obvious. You cannot read it now because the words can only be spoken in Set's presence. Once before him, Sadie should open the book and recite the incantation. She'll know what to do when the time comes.
Right, Sadie said. And Set will just stand there calmly while I read him to death.
Toth shrugged. I did not say it would be easy. You'll also require two ingredients for the spell to work. A verbal ingredient, Set's secret name.
What? I protested. How are we supposed to get that?
With difficulty, I'd imagine. You can't simply read a secret name from a book. The name must come from the owner's own lips, in his own pronunciation, to give you power over him.
Great, I said. So we just force Set to tell us?
Or trick him, Toth said. Or convince him.
Isn't there any other way? Sadie asked.
Toth brushed an ink splotch off his lab coat. A hieroglyph turned into a moth and fluttered away.
I suppose.
Yes.
You could ask the person closest to Set's heart, the person who loves him most. She would also have the ability to speak the name.
But nobody loves Set, Sadie said.
His wife, I guessed. That other goddess, Nephthys.
Toth nodded. She's a river goddess. Perhaps you could find her in a river.
This just gets better and better, I muttered. Sadie frowned at Toth.
You said there was another ingredient?
A physical ingredient, Toth agreed. A feather of truth.
A what?
Sadie asked. But I knew what he was talking about, and my heart sank.
You mean from the land of the dead?
Toth beamed.
Exactly.
Wait, Sadie said. What is he talking about?
I tried to conceal my fear. When you died in ancient Egypt, you had to take a journey to the land of the dead, I explained. A really dangerous journey. Finally, you made it to the Hall of Judgment where your life was weighed on the scales of Anubis, your heart on one side, the feather of truth on the other. If you passed the test, you were blessed with eternal happiness. If you failed, a monster ate your heart and you ceased to exist.
I'll meet the devourer, Toth said wistfully.
Cute little thing.
Sadie blinked.
So we're supposed to get a feather from this Hall of Judgment how, exactly?
Perhaps Anubis will be in a good mood, Toth suggested. It happens every 1,000 years or so.
But how do we even get to the land of the dead? I asked. I mean, without dying.
Toth gazed at the western horizon where the sunset was turning blood red. Down the river at night, I should think. That's how most people pass into the land of the dead. I would take a boat. You'll find Anubis at the end of the river.
He pointed north, then changed his mind and pointed south.
Forgot, rivers flow south here. Everything is backward.
Ugh!
Hufu ran his fingers down the frets of the guitar and ripped out a massive rock and roll riff. Then he belched as if nothing had happened and set down the guitar. Sadie and I just stared at him, but Toth nodded as if the baboon had said something profound.
Are you sure, Hufu?
Toth asked. Hufu grunted.
Very well.
Toth sighed.
Hufu says he would like to go with you. I told him he could stay here and type my doctoral thesis on quantum physics, but he's not interested.
Can't imagine why, Sadie said. Glad to have Hufu along, but where do we find a boat?
You are the blood of pharaohs, Toth said. Pharaohs always have access to a boat.
Just make sure you use it wisely. He nodded toward the river. Churning toward the shore was an old-fashioned paddle-wheel steamboat with smoke billowing from its stacks. I wish you a good journey, Toth said, until we meet again. We're supposed to take that? I asked. But when I turned to look at Toth, he was gone, and he'd taken the barbecue with him.
Wonderful, Sadie muttered.
Ugh! Hufu agreed. He took our hands and led us down to the shore. 26. Aboard the Egyptian Queen. As far as rides to the Land of Death go, the boat was pretty cool. It had multiple decks with ornate railings painted black and green. The side paddle wheels churned the river into froth, and along the paddle wheel housings, the name of the boat glittered in gold letters. Egyptian Queen. At first glance, you'd think the boat was just a tourist attraction, one of those floating casinos or cruise boats for old people. But if you looked closer, you started noticing strange little details. The boat's name was written in Demotic and in hieroglyphics underneath the English. Sparkly smoke billowed from the stacks as if the engines were burning gold. Orbs of multicolored fire flitted around the decks. And on the prow of the ship, two painted eyes moved and blinked, scanning the river for trouble.
That's odd, Sadie remarked.
I nodded. I've seen eyes painted on boats before. They still do that all over the Mediterranean, but usually they don't move.
What? No, not the stupid eyes. That lady on the highest deck. Isn't that...
Sadie broke into a grin.
Bossed!
Sure enough, our favorite feline was leaning out the window of the pilot's house. I was about to wave to her when I noticed the creature standing next to Bost, gripping the wheel. He had a human body and was dressed in the white uniform of a boat captain, but instead of a head, a double-bladed axe sprouted from his collar. And I'm not talking about a small axe for chopping wood. I'm talking battle axe. Twin crescent-shaped iron blades. One in front, where his face should be, one in the back, the edges splattered with suspicious-looking dried red splotches. The ship pulled up to the dock. Balls of fire began zipping around, lowering the gangplank, tying off ropes, and basically doing crew-type stuff. How they did it without hands and without setting everything on fire, I don't know, but it wasn't the strangest thing I'd seen that week. Bost climbed down from the wheelhouse. She hugged us as we came aboard, even Hufu, who tried to return the favor by grooming her for lice.
I'm glad you survived, Bost told us. What happened?
We gave her the basics, and her hair poofed out again.
Elvis. Toth is getting cruel in his old age. Well, I can't say I'm glad to be on this boat again. I hate the water. But I suppose...
You've been on this boat before? I asked. Bost's smile wavered.
A million questions, as usual. But let's eat first. The captain is waiting.
I wasn't anxious to meet a giant axe, and I wasn't enthusiastic about another one of Bost's grilled cheese and Frisky's dinners, but we followed her inside the boat. The dining parlor was lavishly decorated in Egyptian style. Colorful murals depicting the gods covered the walls. Gilded columns supported the ceiling. A long dining table was laden with every kind of food you could want. Sandwiches, pizzas, hamburgers, Mexican food, you name it. It way made up for missing Toth's barbecue. On a side table stood an ice chest, a line of golden goblets, and a soda dispenser with about 20 different choices. The mahogany chairs were carved to look like baboons, which reminded me a little too much of Graceland's jungle room, but Hufu thought they were okay. He barked at his chair just to show it who was top monkey, then sat on its lap. He picked an avocado from a basket of fruit and started peeling it. Across the room, a door opened, and the axe dude came in. He had to duck to avoid cleaving the door frame.
"Lord and Lady Kane," the captain said, bowing.
His voice was a quivery hum that resonated along his front blade. I saw a video one time of a guy playing music by hitting a saw with a hammer, and that's sort of the way the captain sounded.
It is an honor to have you aboard.
Lady Kane, Sadie mused. I like that.
I am Bloodstained Blade, the captain said. What are your orders?
Sadie raised an eyebrow at Bost.
He takes orders from us. Within reason, Bost said. He is bound to your family. Your father...
She cleared her throat.
Well, he and your mother summoned this boat.
The axe demon made a disapproving hum.
You haven't told them, goddess?
I'm getting to it,
Bost grumbled. Told us what? I asked.
Just details.
She rushed on.
The boat can be summoned once a year, and only in times of great need. You'll need to give the captain your orders now. He must have clear directions if we're to proceed, safely.
I wondered what was bothering Bost, but the axe dude was waiting for orders, and the flecks of dried blood on his blades told me I'd better not keep him in suspense. We need to visit the Hall of Judgment, I told him. Take us to the Land of the Dead. Bloodstained Blade hummed thoughtfully.
I will make the arrangements, Lord Kane, but it will take time.
We don't have a lot of that, I turned to Sadie. It's, what, the evening of the 27th? She nodded in agreement.
Day after tomorrow, at sunrise, Set completes his pyramid and destroys the world unless we stop him. So yes, Captain Very Large Blade, or whatever it is, I'd say we're in a bit of a rush.
We will, of course, do our best,
said Bloodstained Blade, though his voice sounded a little, well, sharp.
The crew will prepare your staterooms. Will you dine while you wait?
I looked at the table laden with food and realized how hungry I was. I hadn't eaten since we were in the Washington Monument. Yeah, thanks, BSB. The captain bowed again, which made him look a little too much like a guillotine. Then he left us to our dinner. At first I was too busy eating to talk. I inhaled a roast beef sandwich, a couple of pieces of cherry pie with ice cream, and 3 glasses of ginger ale before I finally came up for air. Sadie didn't eat as much. Then again, she'd had lunch on the plane. She settled for a cheese and cucumber sandwich and one of those weird British drinks she likes, a Ribena. Hufu carefully picked out everything that ended with O. Doritos, Oreos, and some chunks of meat. Buffalo? Armadillo, I was scared to even guess. The balls of fire floated attentively around the room, refilling our goblets and clearing away our plates as we finished. After so many days spent running for our lives, it felt good to just sit at a dinner table and relax. The captain's informing us that he couldn't transport us instantly to the Land of the Dead was the best news I'd had in a long time.
Ugh!
Hufu wiped his mouth and grabbed one of the balls of fire. He fashioned it into a glowing basketball and snorted at me. For once, I was pretty sure what he'd said in Baboon. It wasn't an invitation. It meant something like, I'm going to play basketball by myself now. I will not invite you because your lack of skill would make me throw up. No problem, man, I said, though my face felt hot with embarrassment. Have fun. Hufu snorted again, then loped off with the ball under his arm. I wondered if he'd find a court somewhere on board. At the far end of the table, Bost pushed her plate away. She'd hardly touched her tuna friskies. Not hungry? I asked.
Oh, I suppose not.
She turned her goblet listlessly. She was wearing an expression I didn't associate with cats. Guilt. Sadie and I locked eyes. We had a brief, silent exchange, something like,
"You ask her. No, you."
Of course, Sadie's better at giving dirty looks, so I lost the contest. "Bost," I said, "what did the captain want you to tell us?" She hesitated.
"Oh, that."